Hello, welcome to another episode of Cosmopod. And today we have a two-way conversation. Following up on our science series, we decided to do an episode on Soviet physics, dialectical materialism, and quantum mechanics. And this episode is meant to show, you know, as we promised in the last science episode, that dialectical materialism was used by Soviet scientists in very productive ways. We already had an interview on Vygotsky and Soviet education, and today we hope to discuss the debates around quantum mechanics using dialectical materialism that happened in the USSR. And for that, it's myself and Jamil. You want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi there, everyone. So pleasure to be here. I hope everyone's hanging in there in these difficult times. So today we're going to discuss a very daunting topic, which is more so the philosophical repercussions and debates of quantum mechanics within the Soviet Union than a full-on episode about the intricacies of quantum mechanics. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I guess quantum mechanics is one of those topics where people have many ideas about. I think, well, Jamil and I have studied it from like the physics perspective with the books and everything. And we know it's not an easy thing to describe. And most of the time, if you don't really get the math, quantum mechanics is one of those things that is almost impossible to describe without the math. So we don't hope to make this into, you know, just the usual thing of two people talking to each other and past everybody else. So I thought maybe we could start with a question like, you know, what is dialectical materialism and what is a challenge you're trying to answer today?
So, you know, people throw around the term dialectical materialism, right? It's kind of a joke, right, amongst us Marxists that when you have nothing to say, you say that your argument is dialectical, right? That's definitely a tendency. But dialectical materialism, actually, as we, or at least I understand it in its sort of best formulation, is actually a series of beliefs that are not held by everyone, but that are deeply reasonable, that are held not only in the Soviet Union or strictly by Marxists, but by other philosophers of science, right? Other people who think on science, right? So I think it's important to discuss kind of the dimensions and beliefs that kind of compose this minimum, right? So that we understand what you mean by dialectical materialism as opposed to just throwing it around in the absence of clarity or knowledge, right?
Right, because in many ways it represented like a real scientific advance. And, you know, some of it has been subsumed under other fields, or you can discuss what it means or what it doesn't mean, what is still viable today. But the way Marxists study, especially if you study for a sect form, it's like, yeah, there's three laws of dialectics, of Engels, and this is all that matters. And then other people say, like, you know, yeah, the only one that really makes sense is the one of quantity into quality, but the others, like negation of negation, doesn't make sense. And you go back to Hegel, and yeah, Hegel had a very different take. And also the way it was used for many, many years as a hammer, like you're being undialectical. Or some people talk about being undialectical when you say, well, you know, China can have billionaires because it's socialist. And if you can't accept this, you're being undialectical. And then just dialectical means accepting two competing ideas on your head rather than a whole method.
They reduce it to an idiom, an idiolect, right? And many times the idiolect is just modernized Hegelese. And the absolute worst consequence of sort of this thought-stopping formulas, the endless repetition of the three laws, right? Is precisely that. It gets us nowhere. It's thought stopping. So it's really important, as like Rudy and I are pointing out, to be clear on what it's not, right? The caricature, so sort of. It's not a grand unified theory of three metaphysical laws that are true forever and all time, and to which every result of scientific research must conform to. Right. It's also clearly not just an idiolect, because thinking is not just using cool language. Right. Another thing is that it's therefore really let's give a concrete example of actually, right, subjecting sort of all human knowledge, scientific knowledge, to the standard of the three laws, right? I mean, and we'll actually get into historical examples, right? You kind of have a lot of responses, not just in the USSR, but within the USSR of because it seemed that certain results of quantum mechanics sort of contradicted their metaphysical ideas on reality, that, you know, well, then quantum mechanics must just be false. It must be something that we should not take seriously. And an example of this today, right, is the, you know, the IMT with their, I think they actually have a sect position on the Big Bang theory, right? Now, from what I can tell, they say the Big Bang theory is false. Why? They say the Big Bang theory is false because the world is infinite, and so it has no beginning in space and time, right? Now, that's actually a Spinozian-style argument that comes from Plekhanov, right? But if people think that such a vague argument could be used to eliminate any interest or studying quantum mechanics or relativity theory, then God, what an irrational jump, right? So that's an example of trying to use dialectical materialism as a grand unified metaphysics of everything and subjecting all human knowledge to its scrutiny or its standard, right? Not good.
I mean, well, the IMT is probably the thing everybody likes to, I guess, poke fun at. But you also, you know, like all these doctrinaire ways of thinking about the world, I mean, are reflected in many, many ways, you know. But at the same time, people try to talk about physics. I mean, because you see there's a lot of interest about, you know, the question of who we are and the question of who we are, why we're here. Isn't that covered by Marxism? And when you maybe try to cover it by Marxism or only Marxism, you end up with these things. So it's a way you look into, you take the Marxist canon as a closed canon, right? Rather than something that was written at the end of the 1800s. Or maybe the 1900s for some cases, like Plekhanov.
You know, and I think we should talk about, we've talked a lot about what it's not, right? So, and I don't want to like single out, you know, IMT. As we're talking about, this problem is very general, right?
You have Mao's essay on contradiction, right? Where it says like a plus contradicts a minus or a derivative contradicts an integral, which, you know, the first time I read it as a person who has a lot of education in physics, I was thinking like, what is this person talking about? Why am I reading this or even thinking about taking it seriously? And yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I studied mathematical logic and I've turned a lot to sort of the logic of quantum and sort of get. So to hear terms like that, you're just sort of like, what is the utility of phrasing it that way, right? So I think the point we're trying to make is that it's not an a priori set of statements to which everything must be, from which all scientific knowledge must be deduced, right? What we're going to try to show is that it's something like a rational core and some sort of like minimum positions, but the most powerful sort of Marxist philosophy is constantly engaging with the past, the contemporary, and even, you know, even the quote-unquote future of scientific research, right? So, and that's kind of a lot about what this episode is, right? It's sort of, if you kind of look at it, there's sort of these very broad general positions that many quantum physicists and relativity theorists take up in the USSR that many other Marxists, you know, Lenin actually defends, that Plekhanov defense, that Engels defense, right? And these minimum points that we're going to try to extract, this rational sort of core, it's very powerful, right? Actually, it turns out. So I think it'd be interesting to actually sort of start off with those dimensions, you know?
Indeed. So you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah. So I think a lot of, let's break it up really into three parts, right? So the first part is kind of what you can call the ontological and epistemological statement of realism, right? Now, what this means, and it's going to sound very trivial to people who haven't been cursed in reading too much philosophy, it's going to sound very trivial, but essentially the statement is there is a mind-independent world, right? And we can know aspects, parts, or whatever you want to call it, of that mind-independent world, right? So another way of putting it, right, is that the universe, if you want to think of it more concretely, does not depend on the existence of human beings, right? And the best human knowledge aims to know reality in that aspect. So that's ontological, what is, and the epistemological, the question of knowledge, aspects of realism, right? Now, that might sound trivial, right? But there's actually positions in philosophy and in science, and we'll see that actually, that differ kind of, or that deeply disagree with this statement, right? The notion is you can either take two positions. One, there is no mind-independent world, right? And so or human knowledge is not of it. And that is really strictly idealism. And then you have the belief, and it can kind of go two ways, that either what is real are appearances, which is strict empiricism, and so human knowledge is only of appearances, you know, it's only perceptual and all that. And there is the sort of agnostic, it's kind of what Lenin call it, right? But it's also empiricist, right? And the notion is that there may be a mind-independent world. In fact, they may even affirm there is a mind-independent world, but human knowledge is only of appearances, right? So those are the two broadest propositions that we kind of come to the game with to make sense of things about scientific knowledge, right? Now, the other aspect, which is more in terms of the analytic philosophy that developed, is a question of scientific realism, right? And also what you kind of call semantic realism. So like, and it's something that even is like really relevant to people who work in science, right? You know what I'm saying? Which is, you know, and maybe really like, you know, the let's explain the distinction between unobservable and observable entities and and unobservable and observable terms, right, or concepts. But pretty much take, you know, science as a body of knowledge and as a series of statements is divisible into two kinds of languages, really, right? The first is a language about observable things, right? It's called observational language. The second is a language of unobservable things, whatever that means, right? But unobservable things. And that is the generally been called the theoretical language, right? Now, those statements include terms. Let's think of them as what people would call like concepts, kinds, right? So for instance, an observational term would be like a thermometer, a reading on a thermometer, right? The thermometer would be the term. Put it in the thing and it's, whether it's mercury-based or it's, you know, barometric or it's resistance-based, right? And then there is there are things like electrons.
I guess that's where the core question, right, of the social construction debate comes up, which I think we address in the Hacking podcast. But for those of you who didn't listen to it, or just to recap a bit, the idea of, you know, the book is called The Social Construction of What? You know, there is a lot of debate, you know, it's like how much of the theoretical objects of science are socially constructed, because even for something like temperature, you know, it's not easy to say what temperature is. Yes, it's easy to know what cold or hot is, but even just defining exact temperature or exact expression for temperature took many people many years. And like you were saying before, mercury, what does mercury measure? Well, you look at how much a line of mercury goes up. You're not really measuring the temperature, you're measuring how much the mercury has expanded because it's been in contact with a hot object.
Temperature essentially it was first established in a sort of absolute scale through theoretical arguments of people like Clausius, right? So when, you know, as Rudy is pointing out, when you're dealing with a mercury, right, a thermometer, it's not measuring that quote unquote absolute temperature, which has a lot to do with entropy and configurations, right? But it's actually kind of very specific to the setup, right? You know, the experimental or like setup, right? You know, and so, but precisely, it took you know, it took a lot of theorizing, reasoning above just observing to sort of even think this way and be able to make sense of a relative measure faced with a quote unquote more absolute quantity, right? Which was derived from entropy, finally, right? But the other thing is that, so we're talking about realism about unobservable kinds, right? We Marxists believe that there exists unobservable kinds and unobservable structures and processes which explain the appearances, the surface that we experience, right? Just like any statement we make in an observational language about thermometers, we would say that there are truth conditions, right? And those truth conditions are truth markers, right? It's the same thing with theoretical or unobservable language, right? They're assertory statements, they're making claims, and they have truth markers. They are true just in case the states of affairs is such, right? So the thing is like, this is really a really deep concept also because it has a lot to do clearly with the concept of truth. And Marxists are broadly of the opinion that truth is non-epistemic, right? It's determined by the way things are, right? It's not identifiable with like our reasoning, our perception, warrant or justification, right?
And if you want to think about how that's applied nowadays, you might think about, like I said, you know, like that's just your opinion, man, from the Big Lebowski, or the idea that, you know, well, you know, workers have a certain way of looking, but you should also see things from the other side. You should also look at it from the capitalist. No, I mean, the truth is, you know, there is such thing called class struggle. Class struggle is real. It exists. It's not imaginary. And that's, I think, how we should maybe understand it if we're trying to approach it from, you know, how does this play into our politics, right? You can't reduce things to the subjects, like their impressions of class. You know, class is also a real thing that exists, even if we don't perceive it, sir. Right?
No, absolutely. I think that one of the issues also, right, is like, I think one thing that we can both agree on, though, is that a natural and a social state of affairs are very different, right? No, just, I mean, it's very vague. But, and so the kind of quote unquote mind independence, right, of a social state of affairs is not sort of the same thing as the mind independence of the behavior of an electron, right? You know, it's so class struggle exists clearly, right? And it doesn't matter what any given individual says about it. But nonetheless, there'd be no class struggle if there were no human beings, right? It's not a natural or necessary feature of the world as we know it, right? So that is important, but it is also extremely important, as I just said, to remember. But it is still has that kind of, I think Marx called it phantasmagoric objectivity. I love that, right? And it's like, and the notion is that there's still this mind independence, but it's clearly dependent on, you know, there being society. But we can't be voluntarists about it. We can't just say, oh, the way that we interact with the class struggle will completely shape its parameters, completely shape its behavior. The way we perceive the class struggle will completely shape these parameters. So it's really interesting how we're also, yes, we are realists about unobservable kinds and structures, even in the social, even in the humanities, right? Or in the study of history. What is class struggle? It's not just a series of perception. No, it's an unobservable dynamic that we posit to precisely unify and explain and intervene in the complexity of our situation, right?
Yeah, like you're saying, this is not to say it's completely determined by class, right? Class is lived through race, it's lived through gender, it's lived through many other ways. But this is to say that class struggle exists regardless of whether it tells there is social peace, that there is, you know, like Biden is going to look out for all of us or whatever. No, like whatever, even if there's class conciliation, class war still is there and it will never stop. And this is, I guess, what it says, the realist part. And linking it to the future discussion, this is why, you know, the quantum mechanics might have been appeared to be so threatening, because it's like, oh, you know, when you look at things, you change it. There's no such thing as reality, right?
Yeah. And then it's like also, yeah, let's get into it, actually, you know. But, you know, a lot of Marxists, right, in the past sort of, when these new sciences, the new physics, so to speak, emerged or began sort of consolidating, they had a very set of specific metaphysical principles which they believed to follow from Newtonianism, whatever that means, right? But even as you and I know, like Rudy, Newtonianism, if, and we're going to talk about sort of its ideals, right, fails to live up to its ideals, you know? And so to sort of try to make ultimate statements, for instance, metaphysical statements, right, based on contingent science, probably not the, you know, not a good thing. In other words, issues like determinism and stuff, they're never going to receive a final answer in terms of science. They're kind of assumptions or almost empirical conclusions that we take up in certain situations. You know what I'm saying? As you know, like you work very much in fluid mechanics and in nonlinear dynamics. And there's a quite nice meaning that you can give to indeterminism, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the idea of chaos, right? I think we briefly alluded to this, I think, last year's episode. But quantum mechanics is this, the whole thing of probabilistic interpretation, which we'll talk about. But even when you have a field like fluid mechanics, you have a thing called turbulence. And we know exactly the equations for turbulence. If we had an infinitely powerful computer and we could go down to the infinite precision levels, you could solve the equations. Yet there is this idea that, you know, small perturbation, like the butterfly effect, this idea that, you know, a small butterfly flapping its wings in the Amazon can cause a hurricane in the Gulf Coast. I mean, the idea behind this is the idea that, you know, you change the conditions a bit, you don't know how it's going to affect the rest of the system. And the trajectories or what it will be like, the evolution of the system is going to be, can be very, very, very different, and generally is, even if you introduce a very, very small perturbation.
Which is just, you know, and what's really interesting, and it's key, like what Rudy said, is that if you could measure it with infinite precision, right? So the notion is that any given particle, right, or is deterministic. If you have its equations, you know, essentially, you know, differential equations, then you know the velocity and you know the position. And it's literally just a question of plugging in the time, and it's plug and chug, right? I mean, to be really basic, and we should talk about sort of the classical interpretation of the world. But all of that relies on the notion that those particles, you can measure them with infinite precision because they have definite values, right? Now, you have an analogous situation in the quote-unquote indeterminism of statistical mechanics. You could call this an epistemological indeterminism if we wanted to be, you know, kind of simplify and use some nice labels.
Yeah, I think like to point out here is like sometimes people use these labels because it's just easier to, like as a scientist, I know language can be a way of gatekeeping at times, but it also is done because then, like when Jamil and I are talking, we use epistemological uncertainty. And then you know exactly what you're talking about rather than use two sentences to describe it.
So we don't, in other words, it's so we can't subject every particle to scrutiny to see all of its motions and all of the interactions, right? Now, so in the case of statistical mechanics, which I know much better, you know, so essentially what we do is we use probability, right? But, and I think Rudy and I, we're going to get into this, but what's really deep is, so the notion is that we use probability because we don't know enough. epistemological meaning relating to knowledge, right? But what Rudy and I want to show is that actually, well, quantum brings in the complication that maybe it's not even in principle possible to do what we just said, right? For classical systems. It's not just a question that we don't know enough. It's that if we go to a certain scale, things don't have a definite value, right? And so you can think of it this way. Probability doesn't apply to the system. It applies to the individual thing itself.
So it's like when you're saying, you know, a human being has a 25% chance of dying of you know, some heart condition. Every human being will die or not die of a heart condition, right? We just say it's 25% because when you're 16 or 17, we don't know. Unless, you know, you have some genetic markers, but usually we don't know, right? But this is very different from the quantum state, which is, you know, to use a bad metaphor, it's possible this person Yeah, we can't know if he died of a heart attack or if he died of something else.
And that in the technical language is called superposition of quantum states, right? So I want to look that up, and you know, people want to look that up, you know. So, but I think it's really, it'll be, let's actually kind of get into it. And I want to ask you, Rudy, because, you know, you're sort of, you know, you're a master sort of Newtonian, right, in many ways, and in or fluid mechanics and in nonlinear dynamics. Very, very cool fields, first off. You know, nonlinear dynamics especially is kind of making, pun intended, big waves in not just physics, right, but in other sciences. And but kind of, Rudy, can you kind of explain to people sort of when you sort of start to get into physics, sort of the first, sort of the things you start to do in physics and kind of the canonical problem you're going to take up, right? And kind of what it means in terms of the formalism. And then I think from there, it becomes really a lot clearer for people to see what we mean about sort of the metaphysical principles people tried to sort of deduce from the Newtonian program or tried to hold on to, despite the fact that those beliefs were really contingent beliefs that were reasonable because of the results of Newtonianism and because there was no other complicating account, right? But I think it'll be useful to listeners for you to describe kind of the first exercises, you know, you do in.
So basically when I got to university first year undergrad, you take your basic linear mechanics class, which is you start off with what you call the motion of a single point. Well, you have a point and you give it some mass, you give it some acceleration and you see how that moves. Then you do multiple points. So you have several points with several masses. And then you apply the conservation laws, you know, like, well, if you have several points interacting, then they will behave in this way. You know, you'd reduce things to a center of gravity, you reduce things to, and then you write down very nice linear equations on how things move. And then finally, you move into a rigid body in the sense that, you know, now all the points are stuck together in an object. You introduce the concept of rotation, angular momentum, and that's when you do experiments like using things like gyroscopes, which already are a bit weird, but in the sense that they're just producing effects that are known. One of the, I guess, the more mind-bending problems you can see at that time is if you take a book and you try to flip it, you can only rotate a book around two of the three axes. In a sense, you can probably take a book and flip it in one direction, and you turn around your book, you try to flip it in the other direction, and you turn around your book and you try to flip it in the third direction. One of those three directions is unstable. And you can never rotate a book around that third dimension. And that's one of the things they teach you. And you're saying, like, well, everything is determinate, you know, simple equations, and you understand this. And then, you know, you move to more and more complicated problems. It's all a matter of, you know, linear things in the sense that linear means if you have twice effect, if you have twice a cause, you have twice effect. But everything is more or less understandable and everything is very deterministic in the sense that you can actually calculate things. They show you, you know, the laws of motion of the planets around the sun. And they really install in this idea that, you know, everything is simple and calculatable.
So Rudy is very much, and you see sort of how he formulates it in terms of linearity, right? And that is key, right? I think on a more general level, right, though, you make some assumptions on the conservation of momentum and energy. You make some simplifying assumptions on symmetry, right? You make an assumption that there's quote unquote absolute space, really just in the sense that you're going to use the Cartesian coordinate system, right? We all learned when we were younger. And in order to find relative motion between rigid bodies, which is what he, you know, kind of the combination of treating it as one thing, combination of particles and treating it as one thing, right? Then we kind of, you know, we perform what's called the Galilean transformation, right? And sort of, at least for me, and it's because I come from it from the position of someone who works more in computation and in computer science, right? It's, you take some physical situation, you know, a projectile swinging back and forth from some position, right? Or sorry, projectile shot under the force of gravity, a pendulum swinging back and forth, right? And we somehow have to use what we, you know, the three laws of Newton, right? Really canonically, force equals mass times acceleration to find, and it's called a differential equation, And you use that to find, force equals ma, essentially velocity and position, right? And then you literally, in terms of time, and then you literally just plug in a value of time and it's going to give you the velocity or the position for whatever equation you use, right? So as Rudy said, if you have that equation, right, f equals ma, and you solve it essentially, right, and you get a function in terms of time, then for whatever value of time you plug in, you're going to know the position and you're going to know the velocity. I think that's a pretty fair way of simplifying it, right, Rudy?
Yeah, that's a pretty fair way. I mean, that's kind of what they drill you in the beginning, and that's pretty much what you learn, and that's actually what problems that work, and that works really well for a lot of stuff. I mean, if you go into more nonlinear fields, which the two big ones are really, I think, nonlinear optics, which are lasers and that kind of stuff, or fluid mechanics or those kind of nonlinearities, then you learn more things. But in your first years, you really learn these basic problems.
Yeah, and they're what's really interesting is that Kuhn talks about paradigms, right? And everyone likes to throw around the term paradigms, right? But there was a very specific sense in which he talked about paradigms, which is that they are kind of families of problem solving that start off with canonical problems. These are the canonical problems from which Newtonianism evolves. You know what I'm saying? The ones we've spoken and the exercise we sort of talked about. Now things get, in Lagrangian and Hamiltonian formulations, and then go try to do Rudy's nonlinear, dynamic. It can get nasty. But basically the logic is sort of just that, in the empirical process. You got some Newton's laws, you solve for an equation for function of time so that you can get the functions of time for position and velocity, and you got a whole bunch of knowledge at any moment, right? And you're never going to ask yourself, well, if I plug in, one, whatever that means, time, what you're never going to ask, oh, is it going to come out one or the other? Is it going to come out, that's it. I think it's really, really important from what we talked about, to talk about how from this kind of typical Newtonianism, a set of philosophical principles were derived, but were also used to establish the paradigm, but they include, the continuity of change, determinants of change, which you can also take with causation and a kind of billiard ball of causation, reversibility of change.
And these are all the things that are kind of identified in a lot of Marxist literature with the bourgeois worldview, quote.
Yeah. But as but Rudy and I might say something like, the problem is that it's continuity and discontinuity are just names we throw around unless we actually go to a real situation and start using them meaningfully, So continuity in the integral, in differential calculus, is a very specific notion, right? And I was actually, the kind of continuity we like to think about is that in the division of any two points, you can keep dividing, right? I was actually taught by my philosophy and logic professors that's actually in density. That's actually in topology, it's density, right? It's not necessarily continuity, because you can actually have that for discrete systems, so to speak. But in other words, I think it's important to be specific here about what we mean about each of those things. So for continuity, it's literally like we were talking about you have this formula for time, right? And you can solve it for a trajectory, right? So it's changing continuously. You can think of it for its variables, the variables we were talking about over time, right? It's not jumping. We already kind of talked about determinism, so let's not hammer it. Rudy, do you want to talk about reversibility a bit? Because it's really a huge concept, actually.
Yeah, well, the idea of reversibility just means that every change is reversible. Like if you do something, if you run the equations, basically, and you don't lose energy, you can return to the same point you were when you started off. It just means that, there is, it also has consequences, like there is no privileged direction of time. You cannot lose energy. It just means that you return to the same place, right? If you were to play a movie of life backwards, you wouldn't be able to tell that it's being played backwards. That's another of the consequences.
I think, I'm someone who thinks a lot about
thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. So, you know, but you can, it's exactly what, so one way to think of it is that you can think of a graph, right? Kind of in the most formal way, right? You can literally go from the beginning, and I mean a graph in terms of like circles with lines connecting the circles, right? I won't use the technical language, but you can literally go from one point to the next, right? And achieve some result, right? Now, you can go from the result at the end and then back to the initial condition, right? You can make that sort of traversal, right? That's reversibility kind of in a sort of, you know, kind of logical formal way, right? Now, in physics, it's kind of, it's a lot more precise, right? It's what Rudy was saying, which is that if you, for a system, just think of a box. If you change the quote-unquote external parameters, right? Let's say like a piston, right? And you start pushing it in, the internal parameters are going to change, right? Energy, you know, he mentioned energy. The notion is this. If I pushed it and then I push it back, right? And there's no change. And so you get back to the original sort of like energy from before there was the change in the external parameters, then it's reversible, right? It's also called adiabatic, right? But that's reversibility. So the Newtonian program loved all of these propositions, right? And I think we should summarize kind of all of it in Laplace's beautiful, beautiful statement, you know, Laplacian determinism, the statement of the classical statement of Laplacian determinism, you know, Laplace's demon. But do you want me to?
Yeah, you can read that. Pierre Laplace, the French mathematician. And maybe you have the quote in front of you, right?
My translation. We need to envision the present state of the universe as the effect of its anterior state and as the cause of that state which follows. An intelligence that could in an instant know all the forces that animate nature and the respective situation of all the beings that compose it. If it were able to place these data in the purview of its analysis, encompassing in the same formula the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and that of the lightest atom, nothing will be uncertain for it. And the future, like the past, will be present before its eyes.
It's good writing. And I think it really, really summarizes what, you know, what the idea of, I guess, like, you don't want to call it the bourgeois concept, but this is essentially what, when you talk about Marxist philosophy of physics or when you talk about dialectical materialism, this is what they were trying to polemicize against. This idea of the universe that could be knowable and everything was gently changing, that if we could know everything about things, you know, a universe where radical breaks were not possible.
I agree. In many ways, there is a deep, you know, and people should look up Hessen. We'll do an episode on science at the crossroads at some point. It's a necessity. But there is a deep connection between the scientific program of Newtonianism, which we kind of summarized in the paradigmatic exercises and situations we were talking about, say the pendulum. Right? It came with a set of philosophical propositions, right, that were taken to be absolute, right? And the truth is that, yes, also these philosophical propositions were motivated very clearly, oftentimes, by the situation of the class and other situation, national and other gender and other situations of the person, right? So there's some pretty clear examples. There's also the truth that science in the deepest way has its field of problematization is affected very deeply by, so to speak, anything that is not science, political, historical conditions, right? So we were just talking about thermo, right? Now it sounds all abstract, right? But, and it is, in a way it had to become more abstract to make progress from the engineering it developed from, but it was the engineering of heat engines, the steam engine, the Watt engine, right? That really provided the motivation and the phenomena which thermodynamics and statistical mechanics came to take up, right? So clearly this Newtonian paradigm, you know, is not just a scientific set of propositions or an abstract set of philosophical propositions. It was also motivated by a very specific history, and especially in the case of like statistical mechanics, it's very clear how the economy impinges on it. And in a thing like high energy physics, I think, you know, Rudy and I both know it's you know, it's DOD money, like more than, you know, it's the DOD, right? It's DOD science, which is not to say that, you know, Parton models aren't cool and whatnot, but that has been a huge reason why there's been so much investment and why certain phenomena were picked out to study. It doesn't detract, though, that if the theory is making asertoric statements, it either falls or it doesn't, right? So, but anyway, so, and one of the things that's really interesting to see is actually, so, you know, these philosophical beliefs, you know, determinism, causality, reversibility, if you think about it, really, unfortunately, some Marxists weren't so quick to understand some of the potentially deeper points you might make in engaging science while also reading in Engels.
I mean, honestly, I didn't think much about those things. And this is, I think I talked about this before, this is kind of the swap they do to you in your first year of undergrad. It's like you get economics, like a linear micro classical economy, and it looks exactly the same as all of these other fields. And then you feel like, well, if all the others work, then this one should work. Supply, demand, famous curves. And you know, in some ways, it, like you say, you don't assume, like you swallow all of this together because you take them at the same time and you just don't stop to think about it. And only later, when you start doing like nonlinear physics, is when you stop and think about these. And I also mentioned this before, is why I think so many engineers get the case, what we jokingly call STEM brain, or how, why so many engineers are libertarians, because they're taught to think in these very, very simplified terms. And when you get to nonlinear physics, which not everybody takes, is when you begin to see these assumptions break down. But maybe we should return a bit to the quantum thing.
But one thing is I think it is important to talk about domains where those principles are violated very clearly, even in the age, you know, because sometimes we have, you know, there's this really fancy talk of a new and an old physics, right? And we put Newtonianism against relativity and relativity theory, or I should say, you know, Einsteinian relativity theory, because that existed before relativity theory, and quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, right? But it's as you know, it's not that simple. it's not to say that there's a slow evolution between the two. There is really a lot of incommensurability, as we will see, between the two sort of ways of thinking and the two paradigms, right? But it's just more complicated than that, right? And there's a very obvious moment of breakdown, right? So for instance, we already said that causation, right? There's this deterministic notion of causation. Well, already Newton knew that gravity seemed to kind of violate that, right? It seemed to be the sort of spooky action at a distance, right? And quite frankly, today we don't really have a good machinery in the sense that we don't really have a good explanation for gravity. You get quantum gravity and stuff. I mean, just crazy. You know, I mean, we've made terrific advances on it, right? Even, you know, Einstein's general theory of relativity is an incredible advance in understanding the reality of gravity, but nonetheless, we don't have a very good grasp. You know, it's quite spooky, and it certainly violates this notion that causation happens proximately. You transfer some momentum, you know, there's a billiard ball, it hits another billiard ball, and then there's movement, right? So the other thing is, you know, reversibility. We were talking about, you know, thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. Those were taking place in the 19th century, well before there was quantum mechanics or relativity. And yeah, already there, you know, you have the second law of thermodynamics, which essentially says that entropy increases. And what that means, to not really get into it, or I should say, you know, is that pretty much all processes in nature are irreversible. Like there's like we can engineer very often reversible processes or pseudo kind of approximately, but in nature it's irreversible. You know what I'm saying? And that's where you get, you know, I don't know if you guys remember hearing crazy stuff like the entropy of the world is increasing, you know, disorder is increasing. Don't think of entropy as disorder. Do not. Please go read on entropy, because that misunderstanding, you know, it'll hurt you. And you know, it'll hurt all of us. So just don't do it. Yeah, no. But anyway, so the other thing I want to mention is what's called the ultraviolet catastrophe. This should be a band name. I mean, right? Don't you think? Like, and essentially, the ultraviolet catastrophe is the laws of electromagnetism, you know, that were so beautifully summarized in Maxwell's equations, right? They predict that when you open up your oven, you should essentially, to use the lack of a better term, be blasted with infinite amounts of radiation or energy, right? Now, we actually know that's not the case, right? This was actually resolved by Max Planck. And Max Planck used the work of Boltzmann and the work of statistical mechanics to come up with to show that essentially the reason you don't get blasted with infinite amounts of energy, and this is really to simplify, is because there's a discrete amount of energy that is emitted per unit time, right? So what that shows, in other words, is, well, I thought, you know, what about continuity, right? Shouldn't there be this sort of continuous transfer of the quote unquote infinite energy given the theory of electromagnetism? And it turns out you can really only make sense of it by thinking of energy as coming in discrete units, which I'm sure everyone in their basic chemistry class were taught are called quanta. So personally, if anyone has a bit of acquaintance with, you know, some not too difficult differential and integral calculus, go check out Max Planck's derivation, you know, to understand black body radiation, right? It's really incredible. That work was kind of the final, was a huge moment in sort of breaking down any pretensions that Newtonianism could explain certain phenomena, right? Or one of them was a very, very important moment. So, but a black body, okay, a black body is something that absorbs essentially electromagnetic radiation and it emits it also. And it does those things in quanta, right? And if anyone's interested, it's related positively to frequency and inversely to wavelength, the energy of the quantum. So times Planck's constant, which he actually once again got from that work. So, you know, I think now let's get into the actual quantum. This is going to be a doozy. We kind of set up a lot, but I think it's really important because it's also, you know, I mean, we don't really want to, it's not an episode about people learning quantum, right? It's about talking about a historical moment and sort of making clear what we shouldn't derive and maybe clarifying some general conclusions we can make about that history. So, you know, let's counterpose, Rudy, let's counterpose. So we have these tenets of Newtonianism, right? Let's counterpose them to sort of quantum. And let's try to use maybe some concrete examples to draw that out, you know?
Yeah, so I would say that the really most, the two most famous examples are, one is this idea of the uncertainty principle, in the sense that, well, you know, if you cannot know the position of a particle and the velocity or the momentum, more accurately, of a particle to infinite accuracy, you can never know it. This is a statement, and this statement, it doesn't seem, so most people interpret it the following way, and this is how it was originally conceived, in the sense that you can never have a perfect measurement of a quantum system because you always need to measure it somehow. But this way of conceiving this uncertainty principle, it's compatible with a lot of the world. Because, for example, if you ever want to measure the pressure on the tires of your car or the pressure on the tires of your bicycle, you will always plug in something and a bit of air will escape. So it's not that of a profound statement, like at first glance, in the sense that it's not a quantum exclusive phenomena. When you really, really delve into it, it comes from it can be related or it can be interpreted in many, many, many ways, but it just really comes out of the math. When you write down the mathematical formalism for what is a quantum particle, which is something you call the wave function, we'll maybe talk a bit about it later, and you write down what it means to measure something, measure a position in quantum mechanics, and when you write down what it means to measure a velocity in quantum mechanics, you find out that if you do the math formalism, and you first try to measure a velocity and you then try to measure a position, you get a different result than if you try to first measure the position and then measure the velocity. And funny enough, it's not just restricted to position and velocity, which are the two main ones. It's also restricted to energy and time. It comes in pairs. Like you can't measure the exact time and you can't measure exact energy of a particle. So then this was kind of a one of the big mind blow thing in the sense that you can't know both things at the same time. And like, oh, wait, realism is gone. In the sense, there is no such thing as a mind-independent reality. And this posed, I think, the first big problem.
So yeah, the uncertainty principle is that you cannot measure with infinite, you know, the canonical is you cannot measure with infinite precision or precision, say the X coordinate, the change in the X coordinate and the change in momentum, right? It's going to be essentially the uncertainty is going to be greater than or equal to what is called the Planck constant. I just gave you a formula, you know, formula if people want to write it out. Then, you know, there are conjugate variables, which Rudy was referring to energy and time, and then you have like momentum in the X vector and like change in X and just like all sorts of uncertainty relations that you can derive, right? But as Rudy was saying, there's really this, so according to sort of, you know, it's kind of ironic that we talked about these four major tenets and then we kind of didn't mention realism, but within Newtonianism, I think you can agree with me, Rudy, it's rather easy to come up with a realist position because the particle exists and it has a definite momentum and position with infinite precision. And, you know, yeah. So you have that. So there's a rather unproblematic account of realism, right? The particle, the fields exist. They have definite properties, position and momentum, for instance, right? And the positions and momentums are scalars or floats or whatever, you know. they're numbers, right? Like everyone understands that you're going 10 miles per hour, right? Like there's a car, it exists, it's going 10 miles per hour. Okay, that's a very slow car. The 30 miles per hour, right? Now, as Rudy is mentioning, it's just not that simple once you start off from the mathematical formalism, of quantum mechanics, right? And it's a lot harder to come up with a simple realist account of the kind that Newtonians like. That is a very important distinction to make, right? It is very difficult too, because for instance, we don't talk about really scalar values of energy that are definitely applied to a particle, right? We talk about, like, instead of momentum, we talk about the momentum operator, right? For instance, you know, or when we're dealing with, or we represent certain quantities as complex numbers, right? Like, okay, I understand, like, for instance, when you say the car is going 10 miles per hour is true if and only if, you know, that actual object is going 10 miles per hour, right? But I don't get what it means to say that the wave function has, you know, such and such bra and ket, such and such complex and non-complex values. And when you multiply it together, you get the probability of the amplitude. Like what is, you know, I mean, this is a lot harder. I mean, you can literally say in like three statements, realism and Newtonianism, there are points or particles, there are fields, and they have definite properties. Those, and then to extend it, those definite properties change continuously, right? The change is reversible. And that change is deterministic. You know, because at each time it is, you know, at such and such a position with such and such a condition, right? So it's just not that simple with the, it's not that simple in the quantum world, right? So as a really good example, I think of the uncertainty principle, you know, or actually the really good example first is the tunneling phenomenon, right, Rudy? Actually, Rudy, you should talk about it because you deal a lot with potentials.
Yeah, so I guess the idea here that we're trying to get at is that, you know, first of all, it's really, really hard to, the popular interpretation of quantum mechanics is very different from what is actually there because it really takes many, many years of math, calculus, complex algebra to even be able to take a, a course on the introductory course of quantum mechanics. So I guess in this podcast, we've gone a bit in a roundabout manner, and it might not be for everyone. I mean, we have tried to simplify things, but at some level, it's impossible because it is, you do need the math. And the idea, going back to the question of what is the tunneling effect, you might have heard it as a tunneling effect is something that you might have heard it as, well, you know, if you try to run through a wall, quantum mechanics says you can actually go through a wall. You might have, that is a popular interpretation, and you know, it's not exactly true. What this means is that given that you interpret things in certain ways, you know, and if you interpret, like say, all these operators in so and so ways, it tells you, like, if I have at some place in my system a barrier, and that barrier requires infinite energy to go through, so it's not a barrier you can jump, there is still a probability that the particle will be on both sides of this barrier at the same time. And if you let it go at one place, there's still a probability that this particle goes through an infinitely high barrier and appears at the other side. And this all comes from the uncertainty principle, and this all comes from the formulation of quantum mechanics. And that's why it's like the popular interpretation is like, well, if you try to go through a wall, you will eventually go through it. Like, yes and no, right? I mean, it's an extremely simplified version of this, and it really doesn't correspond to our intuitions. And I guess that's why the popular examples become so popular, because they really, oh, I would like to know how it's possible that we can cross walls, or how it's possible that, you know, the Schrodinger's cat experiment, the famous one of the cat that's half alive and half dead.
Yeah, no, I mean, people like to, so one of the things you were saying before is that the best philosophy is constantly engaging with the present of human knowledge and activity, right? And doesn't see itself as an ultimate standard through which everything must conform, right? Nonetheless, you know, one of the reasons I became a Marxist was reasons was the things that Marxists said about science. I thought they were very reasonable. So there's a natural tendency to want to use scientific results to confirm minimal beliefs, right? At the same time, you have to be very responsible and also kind of do some epoche, you know, you have to kind of take a step back and say, like, I'm not just going to make an easy jump. I actually have to study this. I actually have to go to it. I have to study it. I have to take it seriously, right? So one of the things we want to draw out is that with the emergence of quantum mechanics, realism became a huge debate, you know, at the turn of the century. And so let's talk about popular takes. The worst popular takes were essentially idealism. And what Lenin called Berkeleyan idealism, which is actually not what Berkeley thought. But essentially, he believed Berkeley's idealism was that if you stop staring at something, it doesn't exist, right? But really, Berkeley's idea is worse. it's that actually, no, ideas exist mind independently, but in the mind of God. So we have this like weird reflection of God's mind. Yeah, I know. It's like, whoa. But nonetheless, that's kind of the worst take on it, right, dude? Like, it's like, yo, you close your eyes and like nothing exists anymore. Or like, you know, like matter has consciousness and will. And like, you know, I mean, there were some wild things that people tried to conclude from quantum mechanics, right? So there was like a lot of philosophers and physicists responded to that, right? And there are many, many takes and many, many philosophies they brought to it. Sort of this fusion of philosophy and physicists debating, people from like Helmholtz to Max Planck to Einstein to Bohr, and so some of the people we're precisely going to talk about, but you know, these people established what was called the interpretation problem, the debate kind of on the natural or physical meaning of the mathematical formalism, right? And this interpretation problem, it's important to understand that positions like the statistical one, or they're not exactly coextensive with beliefs in realism or non-realism, right? That debate is actually broader. Another thing that's really important to remember is that all of these philosophers were concerned to be rational about quantum mechanics, right? They were not trying to say things like the electron wills itself or whatever, or, you know, they were trying to really understand it, really trying not to just take it easily. Oh, this is just what it is, right? They were trying to make sense of it on the deepest level. And that's one thing we also want to really make clear. It's hard to just use the results of quantum mechanics to make points about realism. And today there's still ongoing philosophical discussions that are not resolved within the interpretation problem. So I think it's important also, so we were talking about the uncertainty principle, but I think it's important to talk about, you know, we were saying that there's continuity. So the contrast would be discreteness and quantization, right? So a good example of that is like the photoelectric effect. You know, it's actually kind of why your TV works, by the way. But essentially the photoelectric effect is that if you hit metals, certain metals, with X-rays or with ultraviolet radiation, right? You actually get the emission of negatively charged, you get a negatively charged emission, right? So this is the photoelectric effect. So actually what happens is there's a bunch of experiments done to sort of show this negative charge that comes from hitting it with radiation. And in 1905, Einstein actually develops a theory, and he says, well, what actually is happening is that there are these things called photons, right? They are discrete packages, sort of, so to speak, of energy, right? Which is inversely related to wavelength, right? And these photons hit the surface, right? And what happens is some of the energy is used to strip off electrons from the metal, right? And the rest of the energy goes into the electron as it flies off, right? So if anyone's to try to go write that out as an equation, as a challenge, you know, but So this is called the photoelectric effect, right? And so the notion is that it's not just this simple. So two things I think you can get out of this, right? First off, it's not just like this continuous beam that's hitting the surface, right? You can, if you want to think of it in a kind of, in sort of visuals, right? Which is always, don't try to over rely on that. But, and what happens is these kind of discrete quanta hit it, and similarly, it's a discrete quanta of energy are released as opposed to, say, a continuity, right? So that's a very good illustration. I think one thing it also shows kind of well is particle wave duality, I guess. But anyway, so let's kind of conclude with the intro on quantum by talking about, in contrast to Newtonianism, by talking about maybe the double slit experiment.
So the double slit experiment is, you might have again seen this in popular culture in other ways, and it's an extremely famous experiment. It's this idea that you have a screen and then you make two slits on it, so two cuts. And then the idea is you have a sort of electron making machine or electron firing machine. And the idea is that if you throw an electron at this screen that has two holes in it, the electron, in very simplified terms, will interfere with itself in such a way that it looks like it's traveling through both holes at the same time. And if you look at how the electrons will look at when they put a screen after the two holes, and if you look at how the electrons light up that screen, it looks like the electrons are interfering with itself when the electron is supposed to be a single particle. However, if you try to look at the electron and try to look at what it's doing, you keep track of this thing, it stops doing that. The electron behaves like a particle and doesn't interfere with itself. It just goes through one hole or the other.
And as soon as you hit it through the double slit, it creates this interference pattern, right? Then close one off, you get another pattern. Close one of the other slit off, you get another pattern, right? Open them both, you don't get the additive pattern. You don't get that. If you were to look at the situation, and I tell people, your guess would probably be, well, it's additive, right? That'd be your intuition, right? Now, put photodetectors in front of the slits. As soon as you try to see if it's going through one or the other slit, you create the additive curve, actually. So in trying to measure, so to speak, in having those real physical photodetectors interact as analyzers with the source, right, it determines a different behavior, right? And that has nothing to do with, it wills itself, right? No, but there is,
and Rudy, you know, there is something spooky about it, right? It's like almost like the electron's like dealing with itself at two different positions. Like what is, and that's actually why, that's where Everett's many worlds comes from, right? He literally says there are other worlds where there are other electrons that are shadow electrons that only deal with the electron in one or the other slit and that produce those effects. Wow, okay, I guess.
And this is again, yeah, this is again another place where realism like really appears to break down in the sense that, you know, it's not independent of us. It's a sense that depends on when you look at it or not, the electron will do something or other one. And then if you bring in the many worlds, like it's the, all the shadow worlds are only interacting with this world if we stop looking at it. And, you know, these are like where the really, really philosophical questions pop in and where this Marxist idea of realism begins to falter a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? And I think one thing is that, well, you know, the unproblematic realism of Newtonianism, right? And then the other thing is that I think people have to kind of start deeply thinking about the concept of truth and clarifying what that means, right? Maybe a kind of simplistic correspondence theory or deflationary account isn't sufficient, right? Maybe we need a bivalent, maybe we need a multi-valued logic. I actually had a philosophy professor who's sort of like, why do we all think that truth is bivalent? Like that's a metaphysical assumption.
So bivalent means it's either true or false. It can't be, yeah.
It can't be one or the other, right? So, or sorry, both. So, well, there's actually a very precise way of saying that that's not the issue. But anyway, so like, yeah, no, I mean, we might have to think it in more, we might have to change up some stuff and we might have to think about, you know, so for instance, we don't think in terms of determinism as much anymore, even though some aspects of reality are, right? We don't think in purely in terms of continuity, right? You know, and one thing is that, you know, like Bohr, one of the founders of this, he definitely never meant like when you sort of like measure something, you change its being, right? Its fundamental character or something. Because for him, it was kind of nonsense to even attribute definite values before the measurement. They don't have them, right? So, and that can be, as Bohm will develop, because he kind of opposed himself to the way that quantum evolved around the concept of quantum state and Braquette. He actually kind of tried to take this from Bohr, you know what I'm saying? Which is inspiration, right? If Marxists have very often spoken of in terms of holism, you know, not, which for me really means anti-reductionism. Bohm would say it's impossible, you know, it's, we shouldn't even talk about before the measurement there being a thing with definite properties. Ontologically, they do not have definite properties. They are themselves, the properties are themselves probabilistic or non-bivalent in a way, right? So, and that's, we'll pick that, that'll be, you know, this sort of the ontological interpretation is going to be kind of a driving force in the debates of whether it's dealing with the Copenhagen or it's proposing something new. There's really that driving concern, you know?
Yeah, so I guess it sets up the debate a bit, and maybe just sometimes we might drop terms without realizing, but the idea was, you know, the Copenhagen interpretation was kind of known that way because of the Danish city. And it's what generally is, it's really, really hard to pinpoint. Like if you ask people what Copenhagen is, interpretation is, it's all over the place, but that's generally very associated to the name of Niels Bohr and Heisenberg, but especially Niels Bohr because he's Danish and he was the one who led those conferences. And the idea is, you know, it's more of a probabilistic interpretation in the sense that, you know, what you're measuring in quantum mechanics is really probabilities, right? There is, things don't have a definite value, things have a probability of having this value or this other value. Meanwhile, there were other people who were trying to retain ideas of, you know, no, things actually have values. What we don't have is enough information. And that's what maybe is associated more with the name of Bohm or the pilot wave theorem.
Yeah. And there's, well, pilot wave, actually, I think, I won't get too much into it because I'm really fascinated by Bohmian mechanics, you know, but he actually will agree with, so one thing about Bohm was that Bohm was an American physicist, right? And he was a communist, he was a Marxist, and he got hounded by the House's Un-American Activities Committee.
And so he was actually more or less exiled to Brazil for a period. But he essentially was disturbed by the positivism. I think we should be clear about this term. The positivism of a lot of the sort of founders of quantum mechanics, you know, sort of their work became known as the Copenhagen interpretation, right? But he wanted to provide an alternative. And he makes very clear that in his best period, because he actually ends up becoming a mystic, essentially, at the end of his life. But a really irrationalist one, right? But which shows you the dangers of extreme holism. But he was very much concerned with providing a realistic, and not deterministic, but causal interpretation of quantum mechanics, right? The notion is, like as Rudy is saying, it's like things are themselves probabilistic. Causation is itself probabilistic. Change is itself, at the quantum scale, not deterministic. It's indeterministic in the sense that things are themselves probabilistic. It's not because we don't know enough or have enough information, right? So I think another thing that Rudy made very clear is that the Copenhagen it's now identified, right, as the predominant framework. Go pick up an American, and they're going to say, here's some interpretations in the famous Griffiths book, the cat book, which anyone who first takes their quantum, you know, they say, here's the statistical. They don't go over any other interpretations. Then they say, it doesn't really matter. Shut up and compute. The Copenhagen framework is the one that's worked best, has had the most empirical success. And that's also because more people have worked it. But, you know, it has more empirical success. And so this is the one we're going to stick to. And pretty much most issues that realistic-minded quantum mechanics people have is sort of the reliance on certain statements of measurement and the collapse of the wave function and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, so I think it's important now to talk about the positivism of the founders to some degree, and how they thought that people like Planck, people like Dirac, thought that science was nothing but a way of unifying appearances, right? It wasn't necessarily a mode of description or explanation of the natural world phenomenon. And it's especially to that idea that people in the USSR will be, you know, they'll find wrong and quite frankly dangerous, right?
So I guess I'm not that familiar with that bit of the debate. This is the idea of, you know, the Vienna circles, or?
Yeah. So I won't get too much into it, but essentially what happened was, in the 19th century, there was a lot of neo-Kantianism that was very dominant. Actually, if anyone is into the Austrian Marxists, they're into some Marxist neo-Kantians, Bauer, et cetera, right? And it was really the predominant sort of philosophy in Germany and a lot of Europe at the time. There was also sort of the vulgar materialism of Buchner, which is something that Marx criticized. And then there was finally sort of like the philosophy of the physicists, people like Helmholtz, people like Planck, right? And they actually, Planck ended up training a young guy called Maurice Schlitz. Maurice Schlitz ended up doing his PhD in physics, but then he ended up establishing something called the Vienna Circle. And the Vienna Circle was a collection of philosophers and physicists and scientists who were essentially there to make sense of all of these changes, fundamental changes and qualitative jumps in human knowledge, right? And they were also very much concerned with essentially just providing epistemological foundations to science. And they came up with the very, to just give a slogan, they came up with the very meaningful phrase that a statement is really only meaningful if it's verifiable, which essentially means that the statement is only meaningful if it can be reduced to observational language, going back to what we were talking about before, right?
It's worth noting that from here, Karl Popper and this whole thing comes out eventually after many decades. But yeah, that's positivism. And
I think it's just really important to emphasize that Planck taught one of the founders of neo-positivism, of logical positivism, that was best represented in Vienna and the Berlin School, right? Vienna Circle and the Berlin School, right? So it's very clear that from the get-go, when these founders of quantum physics are getting into formulating this new science and program, that they are very heavily, they're very philosophical people, and very heavily interacting with neo-Kantianism and with logical positivism, right? It's very important to understand that. Like, Bohr loves logical positivism, right? As we were saying, there's that anti-realist valence to it, which is that science doesn't actually describe anything real, so to speak, right? It's really a means of unifying appearances. And so that it's pretty clear that the philosophy had influences even in the formulation of the science. And so there's a reason why a lot of the people in the USSR, even though they like aspects of Copenhagen, people like Falk, they're still going to push against the positivism, right? They think there's a kind of positivist enwrapping to the rational core.
Indeed. And that's, I mean, it's worth noting that these people are the same. Well, you know, when Lenin's kind of celebrated materialism and imperial criticism, he is criticizing the Vienna Circle and the Neo-Kantians and everything around this. So whenever you get to the USSR, there is already going to be a very negative reaction, because if you're taking Lenin as your baseline, these people are already opposed to the basic premises. So what you see in some of, I would guess, the best minds of the USSR is a way of taking out the basically the useful bits, or what would be like the real, the structure of reality that quantum mechanics is grasping at, and reframing it in such a way that it is more consistent with dialectical materialism.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that also has to be remembered, so yeah, Lenin was really responding to, you know, Bogdanov and their adoption of neo-Kantianism, you know what I'm saying? And Lenin had great points, which actually are not irreconcilable with even the Copenhagen interpretation, right? His primary point is not any metaphysics. It's not any specific propositions about the character and structure of matter and energy and anything like that, right? It's actually what we're talking about. It's realism, right? And it really is more not the scientific realism we were talking about, the realism about unobservable entities. It's really more about the more basic propositions, right? Realism about the world, right? And the knowability of the world. And essentially what Lenin argues, and you know, everyone likes to shit on the work. And okay, to be honest, you know, I mean, there's some bad parts to it and whatnot. But his analytic strength is to pose what I call Lenin's fork, which is, okay, I can't really build up the terms, but it's essentially this, to be really like brief. If you affirm that there is a mind-independent world, but then you say that you only know appearances, then how do you know there is a mind-independent world? The second proposition undermines the first. I call it Lenin's fork. And it's the analytic core of that work, right? And if people can't grasp that, oh, he's such a bad, then they really don't even start to begin to understand what a lot of Marxists, Marx, Engels, saw as kind of the minimal core of their philosophy, right? Now, one thing I actually find interesting is that you can actually find some very strong evidence of scientific realism or some kind of anachronistic version of it in Marx's time in Capital, right? When he talks about the distinction of him with Hegel and how it reflects, right? It reflects the object, not the other way. But one should look at the, I think it's the preface to the second edition, the French edition or something like that, where he makes the statement. But it's a mature Marx making a very clear statement that they're unobservable entities, and your theory only makes sense not if you've created these entities and talked about them, but whether or not your theory actually gives you information about them. Whether it corresponds completely is another thing, right? So I think it's important to talk about that lineage in Marxist history. So people came to, I don't like, it's probably more political than anything, but people came to kind of see like the Copenhagen interpretation, also because these were bourgeois scientists, right? In bourgeois countries, in capitalist nations, right? Just too cool. And so they would focus on the philosophy of what they had said and then sort of go to Lenin and try to say, well, Lenin hates this, right? You know, I think it's more them trying to confirm their own you know, confirm their own politics in the reading of Lenin, right? Now, it's fair to analyze the bourgeois influences on science, but, you know, I mean, as people in the USSR, like folks showed, you can be a socialist, a Marxist, and even be into the Copenhagen interpretation and be a realist and completely kill it, because Folk was like one of the most important physicists of the 20th century.
And he's completely written out of history.
You know how he isn't? Because he'll open up any book on quantum on quantum field theory. And he's like, so people like to talk about Hilbert space. There's Folk space. That's how vital. Like, if there's a quote unquote bracket, for it, like, begins with a lot of the math that Folk built up. But yeah, he was a monster. Like, Feynman and him are probably more responsible than anyone else for the advance on quantum mechanics, even harder, if you can imagine, quantum field theory, right? So, you know, and he evolved a lot in his stance, but the overriding concern was to show that, okay, I can be into the Copenhagen interpretation, and even in this, which is considered irredeemably positivist, no, I can actually reconcile the realism of a Lenin with it and be completely at home with it. And I think before any Marxist starts, you know, first they should always study hard, you know what you're talking about. But I think that once you've studied enough of it, you kind of realize, like, the interpretations debate is not going to let you say, I'm an idealist, I'm a realist, I'm an empiricist, right? There's no matter of the fact from studying it that you're going to become one or the other, right? You're going to be able to use those philosophies, and hopefully if you're a Marxist, be a realist in the ways we talk about, and really kind of make sense, clarify, be able to explain to others what exactly we do when we do quantum mechanics.
Yeah. And it's worth noting that Falk starts working on this after the Second World War and even after the death of Stalin, right? So I think the first book on quantum mechanics was in 1948, Omelianovsky publishes Lenin and 20th Century Physics. And that was the first attempt, you know, at trying to reconcile Copenhagen interpretation with realism. But then Falk is really the one who takes this all the way, right? And Falk, I mean, he was a very important scientist on his own right. He conversed with Niels Bohr, and he had very long debates with Niels Bohr. And I think some people quote him on saying that, you know, Bohr changed his way of thinking about reality and positivism after talking to Falk in 1957. And Falk was able, you know, because he was observing dialectical, basically he was a big student of dialectical materialism and a student of physics and also brilliant, he was able to articulate his thoughts in a way that were both consistent, I would say, with the Lenin interpretation of dialectical materialism and with what was known in physics, much more than, say, what we get with Lysenko, right? That was a complete abandonment of science.
Yeah, it has to be emphasized, like Rudy is saying, the pure quality of physics in the Soviet Union. Absolutely no one was as good as them, quite frankly. I think we can both agree on that. And it was because, you know, there may have been, you know, the political leadership may have had some opinions or whatever, right, on quantum, but finally for historical, political, class, and other national and other reasons, right, they didn't intervene in the leadership, the scientific leadership of physics, right? And so, you know, with the way that there was such tremendous investment in education and in the institutions, physics became, no one competes, you know, I mean, it's incredible. What's the saying, Rudy, about...
Yeah, if he was able to be solved by pen and paper, the Soviets are probably 20 years ahead of us. Or nowadays, if it was solved by pen and paper, it's probably somewhere in the Russian archives untranslated.
There's a lot of truth to that. You know what I'm saying?
Graham mentions it several times during the books we read for the previous episodes, that really, like, the Americans thought, like, you know, if it's doable by pen and paper, the Soviets already have it. If you require a lot of money to do a big experiment, then probably we are ahead.
They were, and it had been a tradition also of them having been good at the blackboard sciences.
Yeah.
Right. Sciences that you can do without, which I I'm in a lab and I'm going to just blow up the continent. So I don't, but they're incredible at the blackboard sciences. And then you contrast that to the way that historical, political, and social conditions wreak havoc on the fragility of the scientific institutions and leadership in the person of Lyshenko and Lyshenkoism. And it's a depressing, but also, I mean, it also reminds us what it's not a question of keeping philosophy out, right, in order to attain that level. It's just, we have to protect, just like any human, important human activity in society, we have to protect it. It's fragile, right? And when the wrong motives get in, it's our responsibility as Marxists to fight that. We would, we do, and that's basically the point of this podcast. So, but it's a tragedy what happened to Lyshenko. That being said, look, the Russians have they're experts in microphage. They're very much experts in that. They had a tradition of that. I think it comes from the fact that many physicists went into biophysics, essentially. Or biologists started doing kind of biophysics to get around Lyshenko, right? As a quick anecdote, actually, like my mother studied biology in Russia, and many of her teachers were Russians, you know? So even though, you know, it was quote unquote worse than quote unquote physics. And even though there were reasons for that, they still had quite the level. Yeah. She had a good education. You know, she told me they were good educators. They're very, 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 very hard, not very pleasant.
So then going back a bit to the controversy. So I guess what Fok was really interested in is going against the Bohr's idea that, you know, the measurement was the key, right? Or he was, I think it was Bohr saying that he really concentrated on the idea that measurement, there is no reality. It's only when you're measurement, you get reality. And Fok disagreed with him and mentioned a lot of times that, you know, no, it's there are objectively existing laws of nature, and that there is a hard core of quantum mechanics, and that it is real and it's not subjectivist. And the idea is that, you know, even if you interpret this wave function as probabilistic, it doesn't mean that, you know, again, this idea of going back to the point about unobservable objects, it's like, it's not that unobservable objects don't exist, it's that we can postulate them and see how they affect reality. And this is still realism. We're keeping within the bounds of realism. And this is how Fok managed to essentially make a dialectical materialist interpretation of quantum mechanics possible, in the sense that he didn't deny the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics. He just said, this is fine as long as we take it within this and this and this framework.
Absolutely. So one thing that Bohr had kind of been, and he changed his ideas, but earlier he was, you know, he would speak of the particle, so to speak, having absolutely none of these dynamical variables, right? And the very act of measurement determines those variables, right? And it was the intervention of people like Fok that actually had him kind of go against this take sort of, and to go more towards the understanding that, no, actually it does, but probabilistic, right? There is probabilistic behavior independent of measurement, right? Now, it is true, though, that measurement, insofar as it's a physical process, right, affects the distribution, so to speak, of those particles as a way of thinking about it, right? And so that's why Fok, at certain points in his career, really like to talk about sort of, you know, we're debating a lot about the realism of the wave function, right? Now, we were talking about the differential equation. That should just kind of strictly represent a trajectory, right? So the question is, like, what on earth does the wave function represent, right? And Fok's response was, well, it doesn't represent like some quantum trajectory or anything like that. Actually, no, what it is itself is a piece of information on sort of the distribution and dynamical behavior of that particle, right?
I guess maybe we didn't mention it clearly up to now, but the whole debate was on, you know, quantum mechanics, you have this object called a wave function. And what the mathematical formulation, what that represents in reality was the big question mark. And this idea, you know, what the Copenhagen people were saying, or what is called the probabilistic interpretation, is that this represents a probability. What Fok was claiming is that, you know, well, it's a probability, but it's not a probability mediated by measurement. It's a probability that is actually real. It's a deep structure of the universe. While the Copenhagen people insisted that without measurement, you didn't have reality.
Absolutely. And this contrasts to another take that people tried to play on in the Soviet Union, which is the ensemble interpretation, right? So folk would say, like, you know, there's a single particle and it has that probabilistic character, right? But people like Blokhinshtev tried to argue that, no, actually, we talk about, you know, for instance, energy or momentum applying not to any individual particle, but to an ensemble that has been a canonical ensemble, so to speak, not to, you know, but an ensemble that that comes from an experiment with the same conditions or similar conditions repeated an indefinite number of times. If you know anything about frequentism and stuff and limits, it's very much connected to that as well. But it's essentially kind of like a statistical mechanics of quantum phenomenon. It's not quantum statistics, which is a thing today, but it's like, in other words, there might be, or there is a definite position or whatever, but it's something that we get, something we can't know, but we only know sort of using sampling kind of.
Yeah, it's again, the idea I said before of you have a 25% chance of dying of a heart attack. And that's, it expresses some uncertainty, but a single person will, like when they die, you can know if they die of a heart attack.
And kind of one of the things we've been talking about, we've been realists about a lot of quantum things without necessarily being realists about the wave function. You know what I'm saying? As I was just saying also about folk, like, and it's something that I think a lot about as a computer scientist, is there's a physical character to information and information processing. And if you read Tarasov and his analysis of the double slit experiment, he's pretty clear on that. And they like to quote Stalin, actually, folk and Tarasov, and they quote Stalin in saying that nothing can be understood apart from its context, which itself is kind of leads to a paradox, right? Because it's that statement, you know what I'm saying? Kind of leads to something like the liar's paradox, right? Nonetheless, understanding things in their context, yes, is very important, right? And what they're trying to say is that there's this kind of whole situation and the measuring apparatus is part of it, right? And it sort of influences the probabilistic behavior, therefore, of object, right? And that's a take. I like it, actually.
Yeah, I think what we're getting at here is, like, you know, the basic question with Falk and versus the other ensemble interpretation was a question of realism. And this is different from many other questions which dialectical materialism can address, which is maybe the drastic changes, one, the quantity into quality. Like, this one really has not a lot to do with the question that we're trying to address. And another kind of take on this is the idea of interconnectedness, that everything is connected to everything else, which is also not the debate at hand here. And I do think interconnectedness pops up a lot in quantum mechanics, but that was really not a debate being considered in the 1950s, 1960s. What really was at hand is there a deep structure to the universe, yes or no? And I think going back, maybe to reiterate a bit, the success of Falk, which was a brilliant person, is to state, to convince one of the fathers of the Copenhagen interpretation that they were maybe not that correct and that they should emphasize more reality rather than observation. And they did that within the framework of dialectical materialism. So this is why I say when it was a very productive philosophy.
Oh, yeah. And I think, it's very evident the productive interchange, debate, and struggle, and union of philosophy and science in the context of physics in the USSR. It's so very clear. And I mean, I really recommend anyone pick up a book called Basic Concepts of Quantum Mechanics. It's by MIR Publishers Moscow, and there used to be an old communist, I think it was a bookstore called it's in Chicago, Imported Publications Inc. I don't know, they're probably not around anymore, but maybe you can find some used copies or something. And it's really excellent, because one thing that you'll find is they are literally, so this is a textbook that teaches you the basic concepts, but literally the way they're teaching you is in utilizing, Marxist philosophy and a lot of the points that we've been trying to drive, you know? So we've been talking a lot about realism and stuff, but that's also because it became such a huge deal, right? But it's kind of, as we were saying, it's kind of ironic that, like, given all that you could do with certain points made, like quality into, you know, quantity into quality, stuff like that, like all the things you could do, that it just became very much about this one thing, this one debate, right?
and reconciling it, so to speak, with Lenin. It's a shame, right? Because here's an example of trying to use that pedagogically to summarize things. Okay, quantity and quality. I'm going to think of it more in terms of micro states and observable properties, not micro states, but small things and observable properties, right? Well, then the notion is this. Take, you know, Einstein-Bose condensation. Certain small things acting in certain ways can lead to very weird observable phenomenon. For instance, Einstein-Bose condensate, right? Go look it up, right? And the notion is that it is sort of these unobservable things and unobservable processes which explain sort of these vast qualitative or phenomenological differences, right? So that's like an example of like trying to use one of the formulas, so to speak, within the context of a contemporary physics, right? But it's sort of like the problem was that it was so politicized that it's almost like they just got focused on this one debate, you know, goddamn positivism, fuck the positivists, and then completely sort of forgot that there are other aspects of Marxist philosophy and Engels and in Lenin where you can make some very interesting points. You know what I'm saying? You don't have to use the idealect, but you know, there are certain generalizable beliefs in Marxism and Marxist philosophy of science, including anti-reductionism, which we didn't really talk about, right? Which is really the heart of what Engels is saying with quality into quantity, essentially.
I mean, for sure, like this episode, I know it's just been the two of us, and I do think it might be way over the head for some people. But this, I think we are hoping here to show that there were actually very, very serious debates philosophically based on dialectical materialism. And as I said earlier in the episode, we covered Vygotsky and what is more like the social aspect of learning and all these kind of society, you know, lack of human nature part of dialectical materialism in another episode. And there's a whole debate on the origin of life and all the ecology debates that happen under another purview, which is anti-reductionism, essentially, you know, the origin of life. So we hope to cover in other episodes, but in this one in particular, it was really the realism, and it is a big inheritance that is taken from materialism and empirical criticism, right? And that really set the terms of many debates.
Which is fair. I mean, as we were saying, you know, I tried to state kind of the minimum points, and I think you and I both agree on them. You know what I'm saying? Like, and many people would, you know, not so much the stuff about unobservable, but kind of the arguments you made against Bogdanov, right? I think we would very, but those are such, and you and I would both agree, those are such broad statements that one shouldn't just, you know, when one goes to solve the problem or think about a physical phenomenon, you shouldn't just be like, well, how can I use this in order to completely shape my thinking? No, you have to go through the hard thing of thinking. And I remember I had a philosophy professor or a logic professor, Heim Geifman, he told me, if you think you're going to come here, you know, people like to say that logic is critical reasoning. If you think you're going to come here and learn a few simple rules to reasoning, you don't got to figure it out. There are no a few simple rules to thinking, right? You know what I'm saying? So, it really stuck with me, right? It really stuck with me in the sense that there's an analogy to make with philosophy. People think that they learn the three laws and they know everything, right? No, like... They can very much serve to problematize, to formulate, to clarify, to teach. That's what we hope to show with people like Folk, right? But if you don't do the hard work, it's like if you don't do the hard organizing, if you don't do the hard work, it doesn't matter if you know three principles. It's not going to make up for you. You're not going to be a good organizer. You're not going to be a good scientist because you know three philosophical principles, right? You're also not going to defend Marxist philosophy in the strongest way possible.
I mean, this is where, you know, the criterion of practice comes a bit in, like without taking it very strongly, but the idea that, you know, you need the practice. You just don't look at the theory and say like, hey, you know, dialectical materialism, how can I apply this to? Well, most of the time when you come from outside, and I guess this might have been a very heavy episode for some people if you're still with us, but the idea is that, you know, quantum mechanics really requires a lot of math before you begin to break past a popular interpretation and you look at the issues a bit more. So I completely agree with the moral of the story here. Like, you need the practice, you need the experience from the organizing or the calculation or the education, even if it's on your own. Like, you know, sometimes at a university doesn't mean, like, you don't have to go to university. I mean, university has a social aspect of learning, but a lot of the stuff is online, and physics, you can learn a lot online because it doesn't require, like, you can always ask someone and people are can be quite happy to teach you. But yeah, you do need that practice of, you do need to write down and calculate.
And I think we'll also post, but we'll post a ton of resources for people if they kind of want to start on the royal road to, you know, there's no royal road to geometry. So if they kind of want to get on the road to geometry, we're going to try to post a bunch of material also, and start ranging from just beginning into it to I'm starting to get the hang to advanced. And but one of the points we're trying to make, you know, very, very generally, I mean, we tried to make many, but, you know, philosophy, you know, we live in this world where apparently philosophy is bad. Philosophy is not science. Science is truth. Philosophy is speculation, right? And we also live in a world where Marxism is ideology and it's wrong. And what we tried to show was that actually, well, there's really good Marxist philosophy, and it's continuous, but also there's a struggle and a productive struggle between philosophy and science. And we also tried to show that it was in large part like Marxism, and a lot of like the core beliefs left and evolved from like Marx and Engels, which made their physics so special, right? Which made them have their own filial, a Russian school, Copenhagen school, it was that inheritance that made them so special. Everyone else was doing Copenhagen, except for a few people who started. But because of that experience of engaging with that legacy of Marx and Engels and Plekhanov and Spinoza and all the great philosophy, right? They were really able to do something very special, pose the question in a very special way. And as we're also talking about, my God, I mean, if people try to use Marxism to explain why Lyshenkoism is bad, then how on earth are they going to explain the level of physics that was attained in the Soviet Union? They weren't at that level before. Like, they weren't. They had a few people, but they mostly imported the Gausses and stuff. Right, it was after the revolution that they developed a very strong cohort of "quote unquote" homegrown scientists, like the U.S., which is all they import everyone.
Yeah, as I say, like you can't separate the Lysenko from the Oparin, from Vygotsky, from Fock, right?
The point is, like, the best of anything is going to help, and being good at it. You know, if you're a bad scientist, no amount of the application of Newtonianism is going to solve a problem for you, right? Like, it's a very, I think there's a similar dynamic. Lyshenkoism is the worst of what has ever been called Marxist philosophy, right? If it can even be called that, right? I think we've also tried to show that the minimal beliefs that compose it, he never talks in such terms. You know, he never even gets close. You know what I'm saying? So, whereas, like, the Marxism of a Fok and a Bokenshev and stuff like that, or a Bohm. We didn't even talk about Bohm. You know, Bohmian mechanics is still, it is the great competitor to the Copenhagen. There are people in New Jersey, the New Jersey school now, who are killing it with Bohmian mechanics. Like, it's honestly experiencing a lot of growth recently. So, And that was some of it was the influence of Marxism. I'm hella proud of that, you know, frankly. Bohm and Fok and all of them would never have come to such special and nuanced positions on quantum mechanics that influenced the very founders themselves, were it not for Marxism. So be a Marxist, you know, please.
I actually think this is a good place to cut it, because we've been almost for 2 hours, and I think this is a good end point. Do you have any more thoughts though?
No, I think the pitch for Marxism is honestly did all of that just to also be able to like refute the liberal like point of view that like we're idiots who don't know what we're talking about.
And so, yeah, so thanks for listening and hope to see you again. Hope this doesn't scare off too many people. And remember to support us. You know, you can like, share a podcast. We have a Patreon. You get Discord access. You get printed books, all sorts of benefits and access to our study group. So see you next time.